Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I am your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. For this week's episode, we are actually going to be talking about a different kind of altered state of consciousness from the usual discussions here on the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. My guest this week is author Philip Carr Gomm. And we actually did a little bit of a book exchange between the two of us. So he's going to be talking about his book, The Gift of Night, a six-step program for better sleep. And we are also putting that into the context of discussing my own difficulties with having a chronic sleep disorder, which I published a book about a couple years ago called A Sleep Story, an unintentional exploration of the altered states of being awake. So Philip and I did a book swap. He read my book, I read his book, and then we came together for this podcast episode to talk all about it and talk about the process of sleep and the altered states of being asleep and being awake and being in between and all of that stuff, along with practical advice of what to do about it, how to approach it, and how to hopefully achieve better sleep, rest, and restoration for everyone involved, because that's what we all really need, isn't it? Yeah. Of course, both of our books are available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. So if you want to read one or both of our books, go out there and you can do it or listen to it. And that's actually something that Philip recommends for his own book, is getting the audiobook, because there are guided meditations and exercises that you can listen to and follow to help you get better sleep. So we'll be getting to that in just a moment, but let's do a few announcements first. I do want to thank Matthew for making a donation via PayPal over this past week in support of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. If you would like to lend some support to this podcast by making a financial donation, it is always welcome and appreciated. You can stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net, use the PayPal link at the top right of the page, or you can use the link over to my Patreon page at patreon.com/martinwball and sign up for the level of support that is comfortable for you. And of course, there is no obligation over there at Patreon. You can change your support level whenever you want. You can discontinue it whenever you want. And as always, a big thanks goes out to everyone who has either supported me on Patreon in the past or is a current patron and supporter over there. I really appreciate the support that all of you provide for me and hope that you also enjoy the benefits that you get from that, such as having a 30 or 60 minute monthly call and consultation with me. And for those of you beyond that who do want to have a call, of course, I'm available for 30, 60, and 90-minute calls. You can stop by at nondualentheogenicintegration.com if you want more information about any of that. In other news, I'm happy to report that at this point of me recording this here today, I am now at week 5 from the initial onset of my COVID symptoms. And as of right now, it was a few days ago where the last lingering symptom finally subsided and left my body. Yay! So I am now completely COVID symptom free. It was definitely a bit of a long haul, not anywhere near as long as people who suffer from long COVID, but 4.5 weeks, that was long enough for me. And happily feeling much, much better now. And the lingering symptoms, they weren't all that difficult. It was more annoying than anything else, like waking up and like, really, still today? You're not done yet? But it's all done. Yay. In other news, I would just like to share with you, the listening audience, that I am hard at work on this new book that I'm working on that I've given the title of 5-MeO DMT Integration, Embodying Non-Duality Is Not What You Think. I've been plugging away at it every day in between consultations and interviews for the podcast, and I'm now at 90 pages of written text, so it's just flowing. It's great. I'm really enjoying the process of writing this, and I think it's going to be a really useful book for people and highly informative, which is always my goal in writing books about 5-MeO-DMT. And I think actually this might even be my 10th book in which 5-MeO-DMT is the primary subject now. But taking it on to this new angle of looking at what is integration? What are we really talking about when it comes to 5-MeO-DMT? And it's something that I think has not been adequately addressed by others. It's certainly been part of my other books that I've put out there about 5-MeO-DMT, but this is really fundamentally using that lens and that question to look at 5-MeO-DMT experiences, and most importantly also about what happens afterwards and how we can offer integration and support. And this is a book that is written for both people who are striving to have their own integration with 5-MeO-DMT, as well as those who would like to offer services as an integration coach, which I do on a daily basis. So I'm coming from a deep level of experience here and hopefully give them some guidance for this is what you need to know if you're going to be helping people or trying to help people integrate 5-MeO-DMT experiences. So it's just cruising right along, super excited about it, having lots of fun writing it. And just to let you know about what is coming up on the podcast, of course, we still have a few more chapters and appendices from the audiobook for facilitating 5-MeO-DMT, which will be coming out in between interviews. But also coming up, I've got a recent interview with Pablo Lopez, who is a psychotherapist working in Spain and has been very interested in my distinction between non-dual energetics as they are embodied versus the energetics of egoic patterning, which is embodied, and had a really fascinating conversation with him about how he's found applicability for these ideas within his own work and also within his own experiences with entheogens and 5-MeO-DMT. And then I've also got April Pride, and she is primarily interested in the topic of women and entheogens and also cannabis. We had a great conversation the other day, and that's going to be coming out. And also have another interview with Stephen Kirby. He and I are going to be offering a online and also in-person 5-MeO-DMT facilitator course, which he has fundamentally developed, and I am serving as an adjunct professor. That's starting at the end of March. So we just had a conversation talking about that and what we're looking to do there, and that's going to be coming out on the podcast as well. So that's what's coming up in the weeks to come. Lots of great information, but for now, let's go ahead and let's turn to our conversation with Philip Carr Gomm and his book, The Gift of the Night, a 6-step program for better sleep. Here we go. Well, I want to welcome on to the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, Philip Carr Gomm, and I hope I pronounced that correctly. And this interview has been actually several months in the works. Philip, of course, is busy with his work, and what we're going to be talking about today is that his publisher or publicist, I'm not sure which, sent me a book, and it is The Gift of the Night. The Gift of the Night, a 6-step program for better sleep. And at first I was kind of curious, like, this is interesting. Why is this coming my way? Because of course the entheogenic evolution is about psychedelics. But then as I was reading through it, that you kind of start by comparing the study of sleep and sleep medicine as having relevance with psychedelic therapy. And so that's obviously how it came in. But one of my first thoughts was, what does this person know that I have like this sleep disorder? So then what I proposed for Philip is that we do a little bit of a book swap. So we've got my book, A Sleep Story, An Unintentional Exploration of the Altered States of Being Awake, and just comparing the books. I'll hold them up for Philip to see. Of course, we have very similar color tones. We both have a moon on the front, and kind of dealing with sleep. So I just thought it was a wonderful coincidence. And so I proposed, well, let's do a book swap and you can kind of read about my story and then we can talk about sleep. So that's the background. So Philip, thank you very much for making time to be on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Martin, with you. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's just kind of start by introducing you and your background. And let's start with where you start in the book of like talking about step one, what psychedelic therapy can teach us. But first, let's get a little bit about you.
Okay. Well, I came across psychedelics when I was young, kind of 17 and 18 years old in London. So that was the end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. And had some wonderful experiences and some difficult experiences, but mainly absolutely wonderful and beautiful experiences, which were foundational really for the rest of my life. They gave me that particular perspective that you get, that the nature of reality is far grander and more extraordinary than your prior experience has led you to believe. And then at a certain stage, I got the strong message that was enough after having taken LSD, probably, I don't know, I can't remember now, 12, 20 times, something like that. Mm-hmm. It was like, that's enough. You know this altered reality exists. Now you have to spend time reaching these states without taking anything. And so I spent the next 50 years up until my late 60s, really. Late 60s, exploring all sorts of ways of changing consciousness. Mm. So delved into lots and lots of different techniques and methods and, you know, teachings and so on. And then I during that period, the biggest period was where I worked with nature spirituality that's indigenous to these lands, the Druid tradition, and I'm still involved with a very big and successful group, wonderful bunch of people, the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids, and doing ceremonies at the solstices and the equinoxes and so on. And then I handed over the leadership of that group about 3 years ago. And having, you know, they always say, you know, when when you close one door, another door opens. And that's exactly what happened. After about a month or two of having let go of that, Dr. David Luke, who lives up the road, who I know, was asked by a colleague, Ros Watts, if he knew anybody involved as a Druid. And he said, yes, I know Philip, come and see him. And Ros Watts came down with David, and we spent a whole afternoon talking, and she got me up to speed with the psychedelic renaissance that I had actually been unaware of. I hadn't been aware of it happening. And then we had a great time. And then the next morning I got an email from her saying, hey, do you want to work with me on the program that had picked up the clinical research participants in the trial participants, the Imperial College trial that has become quite famous now, where they work with people with treatment resistant depression, and the Synthesis Institute had taken up Rose's idea of giving them ongoing aftercare for integration, because she felt very strongly that these people needed more integration than was built into the clinical trial. So they only had built in two therapy sessions afterwards. She felt they needed more. And so we did that. We worked with 20 of the clients over the next year. And then I was invited on to, during that time, I was invited onto the Synthesis Institute training program, became a pod leader, you know, working with a group of students, and then joined their retreat team and was going to Holland on those retreats there. And then Rosalind started her ASA integration program, working with trees. That was the kind of Druid connection, working with these sacred trees of the Druids. So it was absolutely fabulous, you know, it was absolutely fantastic. And it was as if 50 years of my life, these two really significant parts, one working with the Druid tradition, working with the powers of nature, and working with psychedelics, kind of came together. And so I've been working with Ros in the ASA program since then. At the same, around this time, so kind of that's where I'm at now. But around this time, I've been working as a psychotherapist for about 30 years, trained in psychosynthesis. And my wife had a period of insomnia, and apparently I wasn't sympathetic. I thought I was being sympathetic, but she told me I wasn't. And the reason why was because I didn't kind of viscerally understand how debilitating insomnia was. You know, somebody says in the morning, hey, I had a rotten night, I didn't sleep. And you say, oh dear, that's a shame. Do you want a cup of tea? You know, and let's move the conversation on, you know. And so the gods arranged for me to have insomnia. And I went through a period of, it was probably about 3 months of having insomnia. And it was like, oh my God, this is horrible. I didn't realize how bad it you feel. It's just absolutely terrible. And so I decided to, because I was a psychologist, I'm a psychologist and a psychotherapist, I decided to use my kind of knowledge, dove into that and did some training in CBTI, which is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And around that time, I was training to deliver yoga nidras, you know, which is a specific kind of meditation. And I trained in sophrology, which is a rather interesting mind-body technique developed by a Colombian neuropsychiatrist. It all kind of came together. And I developed a program and I worked with about 40 people who sort of agreed to beta test a kind of program that I built up to help people get to sleep, and made a bunch of recordings with that. And then that coincides with around the time I start working with Ros Watts and the Synthesis Institute and so on. So that happens around the same time. And then it all fell into place when, you know, the way I'm sure you're aware of this, the way you can explore a subject for years and then you just get one insight or you get one shift in perspective and like, right. It's awful. So the one was, hey, why not combine CBT, because it's highly successful, 70% success rate with CBT for insomnia. Why not take some of it, not all of it, because some of its methods are pretty brutal and a lot of people don't like them, you know, sleep restriction therapy.
Right, right.
Like, you know, you're aware of, you're familiar with that, aren't you? And, yes. Drop some of that, but take some of the rest of it. Because it's evidence-based, and then take some stuff that isn't evidence-based that comes out of the alternative field, complementary medicine, and ancient tradition like yoga nidras, you know, and which hasn't the evidence base because people haven't spent the money and the time doing, you know, double-blind trials and all the rest of it. But actually, thousands of people swear by them, and they really can be very effective. I mean, even hypnotherapy doesn't have really a big evidence base for it. You know, so the first kind of insight for me was, well, let's take an integrative approach. Let's take sleep science and combine it with alternative practices. Best of both worlds. Put them together. And then the next kind of step for me was seeing how the way we work in psychedelic therapy, which is essentially, you know, setting and substance, you know, those three things, very simple kind of model, is a much clearer, simpler, accessible, user-friendly way of talking about what sleep scientists and doctors and CBT therapists call sleep hygiene, which I think is a terrible term. I mean, it's rude for a start. I mean, it's like, you know, you go and see this guy and he says, I'm going to teach you sleep hygiene. So I've been kind of unhygienic in the way, you know, dirty in some way. That's kind of weird. So sleep hygiene is a terrible word. And what it is just there's a bunch of understandings about how we, you know, what we do in order to get a good night's sleep. And you just apply them. And the other thing, of course, the other correlation between set and setting and explaining sleep hygiene in a clearer way is that essentially the thing about taking psychedelics is you move from a normal state of consciousness to a very unusual and strange state of consciousness and then come back again. And the idea of, you know, trip guiding and psychedelic therapy and all the rest of it is like, how can we help you do that in the best possible way, get to the nicest state, you know, the most helpful state, and come back down again, you know. And that's what you're doing in sleep therapy. You're helping people go from an ordinary state of waking consciousness to a very peculiar state with having these weird dreams and, you know, and sleeping deeply and so on, bring them back down again. Yeah, you know. So it's the same process. So those were the two insights, and they helped me create this 6-step program, really, which a lot of people find helpful, and so I wrote the book.
Yeah, okay. There's a whole host of things that I want to ask you more about, to unpack a little bit more and return to. First, I'll just state that one of the things that I learned and kind of putting out my own struggles with sleep on my podcast and writing a book about it was receiving a lot of feedback from people. One saying, I have trouble with sleep as well. So it kind of opened up like, wow, like this is a really common phenomenon. And then also with my own particular case, people saying, and man, I thought I had it bad, but oh my God, like look what's happened to you.
Yeah.
So that made me feel a little bit standout-ish to some degree, but also just really opened the door to that sleep difficulties is kind of endemic within modern society, that a lot of people are very disrupted around their sleep. They don't really know what to do about it. And so I just first want to kind of comment on that, which is also one of the reasons why I thought it'd be great to have this conversation here in the podcast, because I have shared all of my troubles with my audience. And sometimes people contact me, it's like, okay, well, what has worked for you? You know? Mm. And so I thought it'd be great. Well, let's just have a conversation about some of these issues. Now, in your own book, you do mention your own bout with insomnia. And I know that for a lot of people with their sleep issues, a big part of it is kind of looking to identify what is a particular cause of this form of sleep disruption. And then there's lots of different forms of sleep disruption, which also complicates matters. And I'm just curious if you would be open to sharing a little bit more about what your experience was with that. And I'll preface that by saying that my own, as I detail in my book, A Sleep Story, that my own sort of struggles with sleep go all the way back into infancy, that I can trace them back to kind of the beginnings of me. Mm. And then there were periods of my life, like kind of like maybe with yourself or with your wife, where when I first became a novelist and I wrote my first novel, Orbi's Vision, that thing just kept me up like every night. I couldn't stop thinking about it, that there was so much more of the story in my head than I had gotten down on the computer or on the paper, that I couldn't stop thinking and I couldn't sleep. And that was on top of an already sort of difficult sleep situation. But I spent my entire life just sort of pushing through, just a little bit more coffee, push through until it reached a crisis point where I couldn't do that anymore. So I've seen different kinds of sleep disruption in my own experience. So yeah, I would like to invite you to share anything that you would like to about your own experience with insomnia when it finally hits you, and that how enlightening that experience can be, because it is hard to communicate to people how disruptive it is when you're not getting enough sleep. And if it's chronic, if it's something that's occurring every day, it's cumulative and it just keeps getting worse and worse. And of course you reach into deeper emotionally desperate states as you go through that. So there's these self-reinforcing negative feedback loops that are very, very hard to break. So with all that as a preface, I'd invite you to share a little bit more about your own experience.
Yeah, well, I think you know, one of the points that I make in the book is that it's important to look at your emotional life, and of course in your book you're very frank and candid about the difficulties you are having in relationships as you're going through. So I mean my sense was it was a relationship issue, with anyone in a long-term relationship. We're both quite feisty characters, and we've known each other for a long time, and it's not always smooth sailing. I think people think that if you're in a long-term relationship, you kind of settle down. Maybe some people do settle down to a kind of a placid state for decades, but we're quite strong-willed characters, and it was going through a shaky time, and I think it was when I think about what were the reasons for that, I think that was one reason, and I think the other reason is I don't know if it's a bit whether this is kind of grandiose to say that or something, but I mean I it was so educational for me. I'm really glad it happened, because I wouldn't have written the book. I wouldn't have started the program. I wouldn't have helped the people that I've been able to help if I hadn't experienced it. So whether it was my higher self saying, hey, let's just give you some of this. And,
have a little suffering to learn from.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it really changed your perspective then.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like so many things. It's only when you've kind of got inside of an experience, that you can really, really understand what it what it feels like, and then maybe have your own journey of coming out of it. Because I wanted to ask you, since you finished the book, has your sleep story kind of continued? Are you on an even keel now? Are you getting enough sleep, do you think?
Well, what I tell people at this point, I released the book, I think in the fall of 21, I think is when it was. And, I have definitely improved a lot since then. Most of like the really negative, experiences that I went through that I describe in the book, that those are mostly behind me at this point. And, sleep overall is much, much easier. And over the past year, you know, as I do talk about in the book, that I ended up taking a rather large supply of supplements to sleep every night. And over the past year, I've really successfully cut out and reduced a number of those. But it's still a strange thing that I still do not go to sleep easily. There are days where nights, where it seems like the night has been relatively successful, but then I get up and cognitively, physically, I might feel like I haven't slept at all,
right.
Which is obviously not fun. But the really challenging things of going into these very uncomfortable energetic states, uncomfortable hypnagogic imagery, and kind of like these weird altered states that exist between fully asleep and fully awake, that I'm very happy that I'm not visiting those the way that I was on kind of a regular basis, and all the very uncomfortable physical and emotional sensations that went with that. So there's been a lot of improvement, but there's still room for more improvement. And so that's something that I'm continuing to build and work upon.
Great. And can I ask you, because your case is very unusual, I would say. As you said yourself, it's kind of extreme in some senses, When you read the six-step program, when you went through it, was it like, how did you respond to that? What was your sense? Did you kind of, because you must have read a whole ton of stuff about sleep.
Yes.
And I know you've tried a ton of stuff. So was it all just very familiar to you, or was there anything, any way in which it was able to be of any help at all?
Ultimately, it was all very familiar. And actually, I would put that as a good selling point for the book, in the sense that I was in such a desperate state that I explored everything that there was to explore. I followed every lead. And so, pretty much everything that's here in the book is something that I had tried or engaged in some capacity. But it's, what's nice is that you've got it all in one place. And so it's something that I would absolutely recommend. And because my case is so extreme, a lot of this stuff doesn't have that much of an impact on me. But also for, you know, as I mentioned, that many people have contacted me saying, I have trouble with sleep, but it's nowhere near as bad as yours. And so that's where I'm very hopeful that we'll try some of these techniques, and actually you probably will get good results from them. Mm-hmm. In a way that I might not necessarily. So like, I'll just take one example of the yoga nidra, where, this was through a sleep coach that did a session with me. And then he sent me like, okay, here's all this yoga nidra stuff. And so these are these meditations where you're kind of visualizing certain points on your body, and then you're breathing in, breathing out, and moving to other points, and you're kind of counting as you go. And, you know, there's different ways of doing yoga nidra. And I can see that for a lot of people have sleep disruption because their mind is too busy. Mm. And that's what's preventing them, that their mind is not turning off. My case is not built around that. So I found myself in bed for hours doing yoga nidra, but not reaching any sleep. So it's something that I did kind of religiously for a number of months. But when I felt like I'm just lying here for hours doing the same thing over and over again.
Did it take you to altered states of consciousness? Did it relax you?
That's a really hard question to answer, because particularly for the first 2 years after. So just to fill in anyone who's listening who
doesn't know my sleep story and hasn't listened to the audiobook that I've released here on the podcast, that in January of 2019, after at least a year of my sleep getting worse and worse and worse and worse and kind of evaporating, that I went 10 consecutive days without being able to sleep. And then for most of 2019 and a good portion of 2020, I was only getting a couple broken hours of sleep per night. And within that, it was almost impossible for my body to reach a state of relaxation, which was baffling, where like I could go lie down on the couch because I'm feeling like, oh, I'm just not conscious. I'm not functional today. I'd lie down on the couch and I could literally feel like one half of my brain saying, okay, I'm going to sleep. And then another half says, no, you're not. And so there's a, what I like to call the sensation of drifting, where you're in a relaxed, altered state and your mind is just kind of drifting. You're not attached to anything. That experience it didn't show up until like the end of 2020. So it was very, that there was something energetically going on inside me that wouldn't allow me into this very precious experience of like, oh, I'm just relaxing right now. This is really, really nice. And this is where, again, with my sleep situation is so kind of bizarrely unique that a lot of people who do suffer from sleep deprivation, they can rest and they can get that experience of, oh, I'm refreshed because I've rested. And so this is now something that I can do. I'm very happy that it has returned, but it was really elusive and ephemeral during those first couple of years.
It's interesting you mentioned that one half of your brain saying I'm resting and relaxing, I'm going to sleep, and the other half not, because I seem to remember is it whales who, there are certain fish that the one half of their brains and the other, you know, and
The cetaceans,
that's right, yeah,
and that's kind of how it felt like that. You know, for most people, it relaxing is something that you don't have to think about, you can just do. And of course, people could be trained to relax if they're having trouble with that. But this was like there is a fundamental circuitry crosswire where the experience would not phenomenologically open up within my body. And it was, those experiences were actually awful. So I'd go and I'd try and lie down on the couch. And it just felt like there was this battle going on inside me that I, Martin, was not directing, was not involved with. This is like, who's doing this to me? You know, it's this weird dissociative thing where it's like these events are happening, but I can't influence them.
And to what degree do you think your psychedelic adventures either exacerbated this or even caused this or alleviated this issue?
Well, that it's a complicated question, and it's one that many people have asked me. And a lot of times when people ask me, they come from the assumption that I was taking psychedelics all the time and that that's something that's like a daily activity of mine, and it's definitely not. And even with a lot of people immediately jumped on, oh, you've taken too much 5-MeO-DMT. And I would tell people, look, actually, when this turned into this terrible crisis, it had been like 3 years since I had taken any 5-MeO-DMT. So that's a really delayed reaction, if that's the reaction. Yeah. But I think in some respects, it actually alleviated the condition because I tend to find going to sleep after having a day of psychedelic experience is actually easier for me than it is on any given normal night. So I think that I actually was, in some sense, maybe masking the devolving nature of my sleep through my psychedelic usage, because I could take psychedelics and then I'm just having the best night of sleep. And then usually also the night after, I'd have a very good night of sleep. And then I'd go back into, all right, it's taken me 3 hours to fall asleep again, and I'm waking up earlier than I want to, so just drink another cup of coffee. But one curious thing that I think might be a factor is that I became very good at, in essentially remaining quote unquote fully conscious during a 5-MeO-DMT experience, not from the perspective of the ego, but just from this unidentified awareness. Right. So that So, for example, many people who experience 5-MeO-DMT, they don't remember what their experience was. And if they were saying things or doing things, they don't remember that afterwards. They have a whiteout or a blackout. I've never had that experience. I just have, okay, here's the egoic structure dissolving away. Here I am. Everything is infinite. Now here's the egoic structure coming back. And if anything, I think that that might have contributed to the fact that I stayed conscious through all of these shifts in awareness through these intermediary states between awake and asleep. But I don't know for certain because it's not a conscious choice.
That's interesting because it makes me think of, you know, I don't know if you remember the piece in my book where I talk about sleep state misperception.
Yes.
And so that's the interesting phenomenon of where somebody's in a sleep lab, so they're all wired up. So all the machines tell the doctors that you're fast asleep. But if you wake the person up and say, what were you experiencing? They will say, well, I was wide awake.
Right.
So now either they're deluded, you know, they're dreaming that they're awake, or, you know, it's somehow a trick of their consciousness, or they were indeed awake, but their body was asleep, you know. To what degree do you think it's possible that some of your experience of not sleeping, that during that experience you've actually been asleep, your body's been asleep, yeah, but your consciousness, for whatever reason, has been activated in some way so that you are awake in consciousness, even though you're asleep?
I think that I probably experienced what sometimes it's called like bursts of micro sleep during that time period. Because when it was the worst, when it was the absolute worst, and I was living in a spare room in our house, and I had both the bed and the couch, that it was so profoundly uncomfortable that I would spend most of the night moving from the bed to the couch, then the couch to the bed, and the bed to the couch. And constantly, this was another weird phenomenon of just having to urinate like all the time during this period. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, objectively, I could tell like I'm awake most of the time, but there might have been microbursts of sleep. And I do think that there are these, I think I'm more aware of this now, where I do go into time periods where I'm aware that, okay, my breathing has just shifted. And now this feeling of drifting is happening. I appear to be conscious, but I think I'm in a light state of sleep.
Yeah.
And then could really easily, you know, I can just open my eyes and break that. Right. But during the period when it was the worst, I think it maybe would have been just a few seconds or even a few minutes of sleep at a time. And one of the reasons also I could be aware of that is that I was also listening to a lot of material during that time period, you know, soft spoken, da 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 da. And on occasion, I would notice that there would be a discontinuity,
right,
where, oh, I now notice that I must have missed something. But during the majority of that time period, there was no missing data. I mean, I could go back and I could tell you, okay, this is everything that I just listened to for the past 5 hours.
Right, exactly. What tends to happen is this interesting phenomenon is that your brain or your mind stitches together the moments when you were awake or almost, so that when you wake up in the morning, all those periods are sort of stitched together as one experience. So
right. So
you will say something like, oh, I didn't sleep at all last night. And almost as soon as you say that, you remember a dream. And so your next sentence might be, oh, well, I did dream about such and such, so maybe I did get some sleep. So that's like a little clue that sometimes we may be under-assessing how much sleep we're actually getting. We're actually getting more sleep than we think we're getting, which is good news. I mean, that's great. You know, we can kind of take some comfort in that, I think.
Yeah, and kind of along those lines, I mean, this is one of the things that I came to a little bit belatedly in my own sleep struggles is you do pretty strongly say, do not use sleep tracking devices.
Yeah.
Don't use them. They're going to make things worse. And there's a complete contradiction of what this sleep expert told me. He was like, let's get you a sleep tracking ring. And he said, as soon as you start paying attention to it, it's all going to start to improve, which is actually, we now know you get the opposite effect, but it was horrendous where I was using the sleep tracking ring and I'd get up in the morning. It's like, oh God, that night felt like shit. And then I'd go and I'd check the readout on my phone. And like the whole thing would be like maybe 5 minutes of sleep here, 5 minutes of sleep here, and the rest is all awake. And so it's kind of reinforcing that narrative that you're not getting sleep. And then even when it would show, oh, you had deep sleep last night, but you only had 5 minutes of it. And then I'm reading like saying, if you're not getting 2.5 hours of deep sleep per night, you are endangering your future health. And I think that's one of the hardest things about having a sleep disorder is that there's so much information out there that says, get better sleep, because if you don't, this is going to be bad. And you're already in a state of desperation. You're like, oh my God, if I could make this better, I would, you know, please. Like,
that was one of the first things I did. You know, whenever I write a book, I always kind of read other people's books about it, obviously. And also, so I don't repeat, you know, I don't want to just repeat what somebody else has written, you know, so you sort of see. And one of the things that struck me is so many books on insomnia and sleep cures and all the rest of it spend a whole lot of time telling you how awful it is not to sleep. And I thought, I'm not going to do that. You know, so I don't cover that in my book at all. I say right at the beginning, I'm not going to do that. And we'll just dive in to fixing this. We're not going to dwell on the problems that it can.
Yeah. Yeah. And I so appreciate that, because it's like kicking somebody when they're down, you know, because my position was like, if I could get more sleep, I would. Like, of course I want better health. But, you know, just that idea of, oh, well, just make some relaxing time for yourself, or just have a bath, or just think positive thoughts and you'll get better sleep. It's like when you're in a crisis, like, man, like you're just desperate. You really want help. And just to be told, like, this is really damaging you.
Yes.
And I know, but that's not really helping.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So something that comes up in the book, of course, and that's something I encountered, and you've already mentioned that there were some brutal aspects of it, but cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. I'd invite you to tell us a little bit about that. I know it's really effective for a lot of folks. I do employ some aspects of that in the whole quote-unquote sleep hygiene kind of ideas. But the most brutal parts of it, I completely rejected. And also the therapist that I was working with while I was really in the worst state of it was definitely like, don't do that. So like the idea of, if you're not asleep within 20 minutes, get out of bed. And I'm thinking, I have never fallen asleep within 20 minutes in my entire life. Like, this is not useful advice for me.
But tell
us more about it. What is cognitive behavioral therapy?
Well, it's always interesting to see where a particular therapy comes from. And cognitive behavioral therapy ultimately originates with, you know, the Russian psychologist Pavlov and his salivating dogs experiments, you know. So it comes out, and that created the, you know, the behavioral school with, you know, Skinner and, you know, the rats in boxes and so on. So it comes out of the behavioral school that treats us like animals subject to stimulus and response, which is true, which is, you know, stimulus response does work. You know, think about eating a lemon and slice of lemon and you start salivating. It's, we know it works. However, I trained in transpersonal psychology, which has a different kind of approach, you know, like Jungian psychology. It's coming from an understanding of the soul and all the rest of it. So it has a different approach. It says, well, hey, in addition to being an animal that is subject to stimulus and response, you're also a soul that has needs too. And the thing with CBT is it's a restrictive, authoritarian, if you like, approach that says, don't do that. And stop, and do this, and it works. Two main techniques are stimulus control and sleep restriction. Now, stimulus control is the idea is that you associate the bedroom only with sleep and sex, and if you're alert, you can immediately spot the problem, which I'll explain in a minute. So the idea is use the bedroom. Only if you're going to, don't watch the television in the bedroom. Don't, you know, read a book. Don't write. Don't do anything. And the idea is that your brain, except sleep and sex, the idea is that your brain then, like a salivating dog, when you walk into that bedroom, it'll go sleep, and, mm-hmm. and you'll go to sleep. Well, as I pointed out to my CBT trainer, I said, well, hang on a minute. Sex isn't soporific, or it shouldn't be soporific. It's actually, you know, kind of exciting. It's the opposite to soporific. So, and he smiled and he said, well, you've struck to the heart of the problem, actually. You know, you're quite right. This is, it doesn't make sense to just do sleep. So he said, some CBT purists say you shouldn't do sex in the bedroom. Anywhere but the bedroom, so that the bedroom then is purely associated with soporific ideas, associations to sleep. So that's one initial problem. Second issue is that exactly as you say to the CBT therapist, well, how am I going to avoid lying there thinking, well, it's probably been about 15 minutes now. Has it been 20 minutes? I don't know. You know, how do you avoid clock watching? They say, well, no, don't watch the clock. Just relax. Just go to sleep. You know, it's like, how do you do it? You can't. It's just like really hard. You know, so that's the second issue. So, and then the third problem with that is, okay, say you do it. And finally, you think, oh, it's got to be longer than 20 minutes, you know, and you pick up the watch next to the bed and you say, oh, God, it's been half an hour and I'm still not asleep. So you've got to immediately get out of bed. Well, you know, I had a client in a cold flat in London that, you know, wasn't well heated. And she used to say, can you imagine what it's like in this flat getting out of the bed? You know, trying to get warm and go into another room to read a book or something, you know, and then go back in again, you know. So it's kind of brutal. And then the other technique they use is called sleep restriction therapy, which is where you basically keep a diary for a week or so and you work out how much time you spend in bed and how much time in that you're asleep. So a classic one would be, you know, well, I spend about, you know, 10 hours in bed, and but I only sleep for 5 hours. So then the therapeutic intervention is to say, okay, cool. What time do you have to get up? 7 a.m.? Okay, you can't get into the bed till 2 a.m. Yeah?
Yeah.
And of course, people feel terrible. Makes them, and they say, you'll feel terrible for about a fortnight. You know, but gradually, you know, and the idea is you build up the pressure to sleep and you gradually extend this envelope. So it requires a pretty tough constitution to go through that regime.
Yes.
So what I've done is I've flipped that around completely and said, what if we have a permissive regime instead of an authoritarian regime? And by that, I mean one that is allowing. And having developed it and taught it, I then discovered that ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy, which is a kind of morph between mindfulness and CBT, if you can imagine that. So it's kind of interesting combination. They have a permissive approach as well. They also say don't use those two techniques. For them, their approach is to use mindfulness, to use mindfulness techniques. As you lie there, you focus on your breathing and do mindfulness stuff. My suggestion is kind of broader than that. Sure, you can do that, but also you can do kind of anything. So, you know, you can decide to explore meditation. You can say, okay, you know, I'm spending a long time getting to sleep. I've always wanted to explore different ways of meditation. I'll spend the next 3 months doing yoga nidras. Then I'll spend the next 3 months doing transcendental meditation. Then I'll spend the next, you know, it's all there on the net. You know, you can create playlists of this stuff. and you can explore the whole world of different meditation techniques or learn a language or listen to podcasts or what I did, the approach I took when I had my insomnia is I never have time to listen to music during the day. So what I did is I took composers that I've had heard snippets of, bits of, and thought, well, you know, guys like you know, John Taverner, who does this beautiful sacred music, very lovely kind of sacred music, or and I'd listen to albums of them, you know. So I kind of had heard all the works of John Taverner, and then I went on to, you know, to other composers. So that's that's the suggestion that I make, is that you reframe the night. That's why it's called the gift of the night, that you reframe it in a positive way. And you see the night as a kind of daily retreat that your soul has. And you can lie there, you can think, you can meditate, you can listen to poetry, you can listen to music, just whatever. And don't even worry about the sleep thing at all. Just, you know, just lie there and, you know, have a good time. You know?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the areas where I found the idea of actually getting up out of bed and doing another activity, one place where that did really help is in these really difficult sort of feedback loops that I would find myself getting into, where again, it would feel like one half of my brain is trying to go to sleep, and that would often present as kind of a buzzy energy. It would go like, and you know, there's this battle going on, and it would become increasingly desperate and uncomfortable. You know, and I could try turning over into another position, you know, and break it for a few seconds, but then I'd find myself like back in this really uncomfortable kind of experience. And for that, I did find getting up out of bed, doing something, like I'd go and open the refrigerator, close my eyes so that I wouldn't get all the bright light in my eyes from the refrigerator, and like maybe drink a little bit of juice or something, walk around the house, look out the window, even open the door, go outside, and then go back and try and allow myself to reset, that then often I would be able to at least not get back into that feedback loop.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I had a symptom that, and I haven't, apart from yourself, I haven't heard anybody talking about it or read about it, which is that buzzing energy. I used to get it in my solar plexus. I'd lie there and I'd get a kind of buzz energy. Yeah. It was quite unpleasant in a way. And it was worrying because I had no idea what it was.
I've definitely experienced quite a bit of that. And something that I still experience quite a bit of is before I actually do fall asleep, like the best nights are where I get in bed, the relaxation response starts right away, and it's like, oh God, it's so good to be here. I'm drifting, you know, my thoughts are happening, but I'm not trapped by them. And then, you know, usually it's a few hours before I wake up, and then it's like, oh, okay, I've gotten a couple hours. Great. And let's reposition, get back to sleep. Yeah. But there's still a lot of nights where I feel an immediate shift in my consciousness, and usually my breathing shifts right at that time period. And it just, it's almost a sense of vertigo. It's like the bottom is dropping out. And then there's a startled response that occurs because of that. So it's kind of like, whoa, there's like a jolt. It's where it's almost like that's the point where I should have gone to sleep. Like right there, that should have been it, but it wasn't. So now it's kind of startling. And it's like, I'll give you an example from the other morning. Was, you know, at this point now, often I do fall asleep within about an hour, and I usually get around a block of 4 or 5 hours where I don't have any recall of having woken up during that time period. And then I wake up around 4 or 5 in the morning or something like that. And then usually the rest of the night is pretty rough before I get up. Not always, but there's a lot of kind of cycling around. But anyway, it was one of these nights where, so I was lying there, and then it's kind of like we were talking about before, I was having a dream then that I was in an airplane with my wife, and one of these sensations happened where it feels like this, whoa, everything is falling away. So in the dream, the plane inverted, and I was like, oh shit, this is not good. So this feeling like gravity was going the wrong direction. And in the dream, I tried to reach out to hold my wife's hand, because I was like, okay, we're going to die, and I wanted to know I'm here with her. And then in the dream, I realized, oh, she's not reaching out to take my hand. Well, that's really odd. Like, there's no way she wouldn't reach out for me. And it's like, oh, that's because this is a dream. And then immediately recognized, oh, that inversion sensation, that's that weird sleep thing. And then I was immediately awake again.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. So have you ever explored the world or the experience of lucid dreaming?
it's usually not intentional. It does happen a lot with me where it usually what triggers it is, oh yeah, I can totally fly. Then I just have to keep reminding myself, okay, just remember, you can fly. This is a dream. You can fly. And for whatever reason, I've really been mostly limited to that, flying and breathing underwater.
Right.
The rest of the dream still tends to proceed according to the dictates of normal dreams. But it's like, I know I can do this in this state. I can fly and I can breathe underwater. So I do that a lot, but not into like the complete mastery of the dream.
Right. Okay. Because that's an interesting kind of world is to you know, explore the idea that, you know, that maybe it's the sort of, you know, in the sort of story of your development or your soul journey, say, that you're exploring these different states of consciousness, and as a result of this, you're kind of normal sleep patterns are disrupted with difficult consequences. However, an upside is that you're exploring new realms of consciousness and, you know, growing in awareness and all the rest of it. And this is how people who are into lucid dreaming as a sort of a way of spiritual development would try to work with you, for instance, or would suggest working. Kristen Lamarca, who wrote the foreword to my book, she's a psychologist who specializes in sort of lucid dreaming and mindfulness, and does some interesting work there. And you know, that might be something to explore, or it might be something you don't want to explore because you really just want to get some you know, helps you rest, you know.
Yeah, that's the overall goal. You know, since we're talking about it, another really common couple of dream themes for me is, and this usually triggers me waking up at this point. It's not like, so sometimes I realize, oh, I'm dreaming, and then I go flying around. But a very common dream theme for me is, so I'm also a photographer. I do a lot of like wildlife and bird photography. And I'll have a dream where it's like, oh, there's the shot. But like the camera won't focus or something like that, or like the lens is wrong. Like there's something in the way from preventing me from getting the photograph that I'm trying to take. And I usually like struggle with that for a while. And then it's like, oh yeah, this is a dream. That's why it's not working. And then I immediately wake up from that. And that one I can really easily explain. But another one that's been kind of plaguing me recently, which is really bizarre, but in the dream of having the sensation that there's stuff in between my teeth and I'm pulling the stuff out, and sometimes it's string, sometimes it's wire, sometimes it's plastic film, or even it might be gum that's in my mouth and I just cannot get the gum out of my mouth. Right. And I usually struggle with that for a few minutes within the dream. And then it's like, oh fuck, this is another one of those dreams. And then I immediately wake up. But that's just the weird stuff that's been showing up for me. So tell us a little bit more about, I mean, are you actually running a sleep clinic now? Is that what I understand?
Well, I run an online program. Okay. So I've put, you know, this stuff into an online program, And then I have individual clients, people who consult me on one-to-ones. So there's an online sleep clinic program that anybody can just enroll on and run through at their own pace and their own time. And then I'm available individually for one-on-ones as well.
Yeah. So are you finding there's a lot of demand? I would kind of imagine that there is.
Well, there is. I mean, as you say, when you start to talk about this, you discover how much of it is around. I mean, at least 30% up prior to the pandemic, all the stats were saying, you know, essentially a third of the adult population suffer from insomnia or sleep related disturbance. You know, I'm trying to remember the stats on this, but they've increased with the pandemic. Because one of the things about coronavirus, I don't know whether you've had it recently yourself, whether you found it played around with your sleep and dreams. I found when I had COVID, it affected my my dreams in a very peculiar way, kind of unpleasant way. And a number of people have talked about that. But apparently the pandemic has caused more sleep disturbances in people. And of course, the population, it's starting to travel down the demographic, down the age group. So younger and younger people experiencing sleep. You know, a lot of that is due to social media, of course. And for anybody who's got kids, they know that experience of coming into the bedroom when you think your kids are asleep and you find that the bed is glowing.
Yeah.
And they've got their tablet or their phone under the duvet, you know, and they're working on it. So it's happening to younger people as well. So there's a lot of it around, you know, and it's quite interesting. It's quite an interesting way in for people to go deep with people. I have a friend who's a doctor in Glasgow, up in Scotland, and he said when he saw my book, he was saying how he'd developed in his practice an acronym which he called SAFE, S-A-F-E, and that when he had a new patient, he would start off by talking about sleep. You know, how's your sleep? How are you doing with your sleep? Then he'd move on to alcohol consumption, then to food, and then to exercise. And he said he'd worked out that sleep was the safest way to start a conversation. Because if you dive straight into a person you meet, anybody you meet really, or a new friend or a new patient, you know, how much alcohol are you drinking? They get defensive because
right.
Where you're going with that, you know, but people quite like to talk about sleep, and it's quite easy to sort of, it's a way of easing people into a discussion of their lives and their well-being and their inner life. So that's you know, when you know that and you start to talk to friends and people you meet about their sleep, all sorts of very interesting stories unfold, which is why in the second half of the book, you know, I go through all those strain, you know, all those, the variety of disturbances like exploding head syndrome and you know, sleep related painful erections and all the wide variety of sleep disturbances people have, sleepwalking and so on. They're kind of fascinating in their own way.
Yeah, they are. I mean, there's, you know, that's why I gave my book the subtitle of The Unintentional Exploration of the Altered States of Being Awake, because there's a lot of different stuff that goes on within there when you're not just getting proper sleep. So, you know, I do take sleep supplements. I do have a prescription that I use. It is definitely not my ideal choice. I'd much rather not to be on it. But, you know, when I was in the worst stages of my sleep crisis, I needed more than positive thoughts, sleep hygiene, behavioral routines. You know, I was definitely in a place where I needed as much as I could possibly do to actually get productive sleep. And as I mentioned, you know, I've been cutting back on all of that and reducing, and you know, that's my eventual goal, is get rid of all of this stuff, but you know, do it one step at a time so that I'm not so that I'm not asking a rebound insomnia to come hit me. But there's obviously a lot of sleep supplements and medications that are out there on the market. A lot of people are taking the, you know, these Z drugs of Ambien and things like that. And of course it's not ideal. It's definitely not ideal. So I was wondering if you could just share a little bit about why these things are not ideal. And then, you know, just to give in an average case, like, what do you think is the best first step for someone who is suffering from some kind of sleep disturbance, short of going to the store and getting some diphenhydramine or some NyQuil or going and, you know, trying to find a prescription. And you know, there's a lot of different kinds of sleep-related drugs that are available out there, and a lot of them work chemically in very, very different ways. So I invite you to speak about that a little bit.
Well, you know, in the book, I go into the reasons why, you know, sleep medication on the whole isn't a good idea. So I won't go over that again because, you know, but essentially, to sort of distill it down, it's a question of looking at the way they work and the fact that they mess in some way with your sleep architecture. So there's this nice term, I think, sleep architecture, which is, you know, the way your the proportion of light sleep to deep sleep to REM sleep, you know, and so on. And what it does is it plays around with the sleep architecture. And from a on a long-term basis, that's not a good idea. You want the body to sleep naturally, so that's not happening. And the problem with medications is that they so easily become habit-forming. You know, I mean, a drug, I've forgotten the name of it now, and in the UK, the names of drugs are different anyway, you know, from the States, but which essentially combines paracetamol with antihistamine tablets, because antihistamine makes you drowsy, paracetamol, you know. So for anybody who has slight aches and pains or a bit of arthritis or, you know, whatever, you know, you're going to get, that's going to be helpful because it'll make you drowsy and it'll cut out any interference from the pain. But, you know, do you want to be taking paracetamol for the rest of your life and antihistamines? I don't think so. You know, and you have the problem, not only of it becoming habit-forming, and of you possibly having to increase the dosage in order to get the same effect, gradually upping it and upping it, upping it. You also have what you referred to before is the rebound phenomenon, which is when you stop, it's like you get insomnia even worse than you had it before. So you have a few days of horrible sleepless nights. You think, oh God, I just better go back on the medicine. So you're back on it again. And so you're on a kind of treadmill. And the reality is that the proportions of light to deep to REM sleep are all really significant. You know, you need deep sleep for cellular repair and rejuvenation and for that extraordinary process of flushing. You know, the way the gaps between the neurons are actually expanded and then the cerebro to allow the cerebrospinal fluid to flush through the brain. It's an extraordinary process. This kind of flushing occurs. And it flushes this beta amyloid plaque, which accumulates around the neurons and eventually can lead to dementia. So it's really important. So if you don't get enough deep sleep, that can be one of, you know, the risks. So it's really important. So if you're taking any drug that is reducing the amount of deep sleep you have, that's problematic. But then if you take a drug that's reducing your REM sleep, then REM sleep is really vital for emotional processing and for consolidation of memories, as is deep sleep as well, different phases of consolidation. So you're messing with memory too, you know. So even cannabis, I mean, in a way, it seems, I mean, not enough research has been done, but it seems like, you know, cannabis is possibly, you know, if you were going to have to take something, getting the right kind of cannabis that had the right THC to CBD kind of combination would be the best way. And the research shows that it really does improve people's, the speed in which they go to sleep and so on. But that still plays around with the architecture. And nobody really knows what the effect of that is. You know, how have you found, I can't remember from your book, cannabis as a sleep medication?
Yeah, so that pretty much was my go-to sleep medication for most of my adult life, using cannabis. And it did help that, you know, I would have trouble getting into that, oh, I'm going asleep. You know, like I mentioned in my book that I can literally count on one hand how many times in my life I felt like, oh, I can't even keep my eyes open. You know, that experience that many people have when watching TV or reading a book. And like, whereas I could sit in bed and I could read all night. I'm never going to hit that point of, oh. So I would use cannabis to help alter myself so that I'd feel like, okay, now I can drift away with this. But, that as things were getting worse for me, that it wasn't helping, because then I would feel that I was in an altered state, but this altered state was just feedback looping into this very uncomfortable not being asleep. And then started using CBD as one of my supplements that I use. And I use it for quite a while, but really didn't get much of an effect from CBD, but then actually introduced CBN into my nightly routine, which is another cannabis derivative. And for about a year, I was taking 10 milligrams of that a night, And that I could notice, okay, this is helping me get more solid sleep through the night. But along with everything else, that's one of the things that I've reduced. So now I have these 5 milligram CBN gel caps, and I keep that as like an extra in my little supply cabinet that I keep by my bed. So I use that occasionally now. I'm not taking it every night. And that's also something that I think can be a bit more effective with some of these sleep supplements, that if you're not taking them every day, then you have less of a tolerance to them, and they actually are more effective. So I try and be as sparing as I can at this point. And this overall, for the first several months of 2019, it was so bad. I mean, I didn't use any kind of mind alternates. But at this point, I am a fan of cannabis. I am a nightly user for the most part. You know, when we're sitting around watching some TV, I like to have a little cannabis. It's a regular part of my regimen, and it's no longer disruptive to my sleep in the way that it had become, because I just simply wasn't falling asleep, and then I'm too altered to be asleep, which is just weird.
Yeah, that figures.
Yeah. So with the idea of someone's having sleep trouble, I'm absolutely going to recommend your book, The Gift of the Night, Philip Carr Gomm. Short of reading your book and following the steps in there, what do you think is like, if you could just give somebody one bit of advice, like where to start in addressing your deficiency of sleep, what would you recommend?
One bit of advice is, so simple, is to work out your chronotype, which is your sort of sleep personality. You can do that online. You can go online and do a little quiz. A guy called Dr. Michael Bruce, BREUSS. He has an online quiz. You just fill in 4 different types. The 2 types we know about are larks and owls, if you like. People who could, it's very simple, but it's amazing. What tends to happen in couples is that couples opposites seem to attract. So larks and owls team up, which makes a lot of sense from an evolutionary perspective, because there's more childcare time, there's more time to tend the fire, as it were, like that. But what happens is when you couple up with somebody, you want to go to bed at the same time, because that figures. So somebody makes a compromise. Somebody's either going to bed much earlier than they want to go to bed, or much later than they want to go to bed. So somebody's going to suffer out of that. And So just finding that out and then negotiating with your partner. So saying, listen, sweetheart, even though I'd love to go to bed with you at the same time, I'm just not built that way. I need to go to bed at midnight, not at 10 in the evening. So, I'll see you at midnight, just that can make a big difference, I think, fighting it can produce, the most extreme, it can produce depression. There's this interesting relationship between depression and sleep. It's kind of bilateral, bidirectional, but depression can be triggered by lack of sleep, and if you're an owl trying to be a lark, or vice versa, you trigger insomnia in yourself, and then you find you're triggering depression in yourself. And just be true to yourself and develop your lifestyle around that, and that can make a big difference.
Yeah. And also, I like that you talk about sort of these 90-minute cycles that people go through. And yeah. I think that's another big one is, within the cognitive behavioral therapy, there is the idea of go to bed at the same time every night, establish a routine. But you really got to find where you are on your target spectrum of, am I in an awake cycle or am I in a down regulating cycle, so that you actually make sure that your bedtime coincides with when you're down regulating.
Absolutely. I mean, I think actually that's the key piece of advice, but I didn't give it when you asked me for one piece, because it's kind of a bit complicated to explain on air, as it were. You have to look at a chart and work it out and all the rest of it. But yeah, absolutely. I think that's the most helpful piece of advice, is to work out in that 90-minute cycle where you are and go to bed at that time, so that you're getting into bed when you're getting into a trough of down regulation rather than climbing up. Very common thing, people fall asleep on the sofa when they're watching television in the evening, get very drowsy. Oh, I've got to go to bed. They spend half an hour sorting the house out and getting into bed, brushing their teeth. And then they lie in bed feeling wide awake because they're starting to upregulate,
Yeah. That's for me, that all of that has been very, very helpful, of really keeping sort of a regimented routine. So as you say, that when I know, okay, this is my bedtime, all I need to do is go and get in bed, that there's nothing else for me to do at that point. And so I actually structure my day around the concept of sleep, that I don't make my bed when I first get up in the morning, but I get up, I drink some coffee, read the news, check my email. And then before I start, quote, work for the day, whatever that may be, I make my bed, I get everything prepared for the night, and then I have a routine that I follow every night, and make sure that I'm following that routine. And that has definitely helped. And also, in line with cognitive behavioral therapy, of even if I've had a poor night the night before, not saying, okay, well, I'm going to go to bed early so I can catch up, because then you're out of sync.
Yeah, again. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. The body loves routine.
Well, of course, there's more we can talk about, but I do want people to get the book. And I really, really strongly recommend it, that this is a guide to, these are proven techniques that can help people with sleep. So again, it's The Gift of Night. And of course, if you want to read like the horrors of when things go terribly bad, you can read my story, A Sleep Story.
If I just say, give a little plug for the audiobook, the advantage of getting The Gift of the Night, audible.com or whatever, as an audiobook, is you've got the scripts. You know, I give 13 ways to get 13. That's where we get to the medicine part of the program, or the substance part, like 13 ways to get to sleep. And I read out, some of these scripts, five of these scripts, and so you can kind of use the audiobook for actually going to sleep if you want to. So if you have a choice between buying the book or the audiobook, I'd go for the audiobook.
Yeah, and that's also something that I can just recommend. I mean, I don't have the audiobook, I have the paperback, but the idea of listening to things to help guide you can be very, very useful. And also, you talk about a little bit about binaural beats. I use those religiously now. I don't know if they actually help me in the sense that, are they truly synchronizing my brain hemispheres? I'm kind of skeptical about that, but the fact that I use this really light ambient music through the night, it helps trigger me like, okay, yes, this is resting time. This is sleeping time. And so having these audio stimuli can be very, very useful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Flip. I'm really glad that we were able to make this happen.
Thank you, Martin. It's been really great talking to you.
Yeah. Where could people get in touch with you if they want to, schedule a consultation?
Yeah, well, that's one of the advantages of having a weird name is this, if you just type in my name, Philip with one L, and then CARRGOMM, you'll find me. I've got a website, which is philipcargom.com, and you can email me. Yeah, happy to do that. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again very much. I've enjoyed the conversations.
Thank you, Martin. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.